The following presentation is brought to you by Rita, the Rudyard Institute for Transpersonal Activity, a nonprofit public benefit corporation dedicated to disseminating the work and essential message of Dane Rudyard. All material is copyrighted by Layla Rudyard Hill. If you'd like to learn more about Rita or make a donation towards supporting the ongoing legacy of Dane Rudyard, visit www.rudyardinstitute.org. For the complete selection of free downloads of audio presentations by Dane Rudyard, visit www.rudyardaudioarchives.com. We hope you enjoy the following presentation of Astrology for New Minds by Dane Rudyard. This talk is 48 minutes long and was recorded in 1960.
I am going to speak mainly on astrology today, but the approach which I have toward it is so different from the popular one, and so involved in a philosophy of life, an attitude to existence, that I have to start with the larger picture, and gradually you will see how the approach which I have in astrology becomes an application of those basic concepts. Perhaps we may say that life for most people is a series of events to which they react in a more or less instinctual, more or less traditional, more or less conscious, more or less impulsive manner. Now, when man becomes more objective, when he is able to separate himself to some extent in his mind from the existence itself, he begins to develop a sense of cause and effect. This causes this regularly, and therefore he begins to get what you might call the scientific approach. There is also what you might call the ethical approach, which is based on a realization that some things are good, some things are bad, that there are things which are very valuable results, which must be pursued because they are valuable results, some, in the contrary, which are destructive to oneself and to society. There is something similar in both the scientific and the ethical approach, which is that actually both, to a degree, isolate series of events and study those events in order to find their causal connection. The scientist isolates certain events in his laboratory or studies certain facets of life, narrowing down his focus until he finds more and more about less and less, as it has been said quite amusingly. The man of morality, the moralist, think of something in relation of a certain kind of behavior or attitude in relation to a particular society, a particular climate, a particular time, a particular race of human beings. In other words, both have, to some extent, limited goals. Both seek essentially power. The power to accomplish something, to get certain result, to achieve something which will give either power, science, or in terms of ethics, perhaps especially religious ethics, which may give salvation, which may make the man a saint, or if you go into a kind of occult kind of ethic, which will make of him an initiate or an adept or whatever you want. In other words, you have there approaches to life which must follow definite goals, limited goals in a certain sense, in relation to limited circumstances, and which have very specific techniques in order to achieve a certain status, as it were. The status of the man who controls matter, who is the status of the man who has controlled his emotion and has reached a spiritual status, and so on. Now, I think there is an approach which I would like to call the philosophical approach, though the term philosophy, of course, today means something entirely different. You might call it, if you want, the approach of the sage, if you want, which has a very basically different significance and brings in different faculties into play. It is not very easy to define that attitude because we are so engrossed usually into the other kind of attitude, whether it is a scientific or a moralistic attitude, that we fail to realize exactly the difference there is between these two attitudes and the one which I am trying to express. This attitude, let's call it the philosophical attitude if you want, for lack of a better term, tries to face existence in its totality. It doesn't select anything for analysis. It tries to experience existence in its fullness of immediacy, as it were. The mind, the man, the consciousness, become, as it were, I think, like sometimes this illustration, though it isn't a very good one, like a sieve in some way. The experience of life passes through the mind. The consciousness watches as it experiences in what you might call total wakefulness. It tries to feel the nature, the quality of what passes through it. Different things pass through it. They feel different. You do not select one from the other. You don't have any definite goal, but you are trying to establish an intimate relationship in consciousness between you and that constant stream of existence that passes, as it were, through your consciousness. Now, when you do that, I am very brief. We can talk about it later if you want to ask questions. When you do that, there are really two things that stand out, two factors, you might say, two conclusions, if you want to call it, which are at the basis, I think, of any attitude of to life which is complete and whole. First, the realization that all is change, that nothing remains what it is. You don't remain even what you are. There is a constant interrelationship of everything, and there is a constant flow or flux of all existence at any point of existence. But if you persist in the observation, and if you have a sense of memory, as it were, if you register what has happened, then you realize that this change is an ordered change. And by order, I mean that you can distinguish certain rhythm to the flow of those experiences. There are events which are recurrent. You begin to realize the recurrence of the events. You begin to realize the sense of recurrence itself. And you may be led to, almost all humanity has been led to, the conclusion that this is a, to some extent, in the larger sense of the term, a cyclic universe. Now, there you immediately, when you face those two facts, everything is change, but this change is rhythmical, therefore there is order in it. You face immediately the basic problem, which is perhaps the one problem of philosophy, of religion, of metaphysics, and also of astrology. The interesting thing about astrology is that there is a great struggle that is going on now. I mean, we can call it great because the field is not so great in a sense from a modern point of view. But there is a struggle going on as to the attitude of astrology toward those two things. And that problem there, in a little field, which is still very significant because of its antiquity and so on, is an indication of the larger problem which we find in all our attitude to life, to religion, to philosophy, to science, and so on. The question there is this. Is this world of change, this experience of change that we have, which is basic in our life, and that experience of order, do they mean that there are two different worlds, the world of existence we live through, and a realm of order, which is, in a certain sense, different from, separated from, at a different level, than the world of existence. Is there a conflict between the two in a sense, or at least a very strong contrast? Can you establish an ethical valuation, the one being good and the other being bad, so that you have to get out of the bad one to go into the good one, you see? Or is that order absolutely inherent in the process of change, so that actually and realistically you cannot separate the one from the other? So that this sense of order actually can become the result of an attitude to existence, to the problem of change, and that it is only way in which you can sense the reality of that order as rhythm, not as especially apart things, but as the rhythm of the very flow itself of existence. Now, if you are familiar, as I'm sure you are, with the problems of either Oriental philosophy or Western philosophy and religion in most of its aspects and all that, you will realize that those two alternatives, as it were, are absolutely fundamental. If you select the one or the other, you can change completely the whole pattern of life and the whole attitude of human consciousness. And the interesting thing is that, as I said before, that you find the same thing if you want to, you are facing with the same problem if you want to evaluate the meaning and the significance of astrology. And if you want to perhaps understand where the problem lies, how it originated, and how perhaps it can be solved, I like always to come back to what I consider one of the most fundamental experiences of mankind. A prehistorical experience, but one which is quite easily deducible from the facts of human consciousness, and which is corroborated by not only the occult tradition, but by, as far as I know, the ideas of the science of development of the earth and the climate and so on. Apparently, there was a period when the earth was all enveloped in a sort of a mist, heavy mist perhaps, and so that at the period, I guess, of the great reptiles and so on. And so that in a certain sense, and we know now that there were human beings living there at that time, so that those beings were in that terrific jungle state, those great danger, everything moist and tropical, super tropical kind of situation, and that mist, that fog that were completely enveloping them, so that there was no realization of the sky, of light, of course, like night and day, but in a diffused way, without any realization of what the sky might mean. Now imagine that as the fogs were beginning to lift, let us say, or as some very adventurous people began to climb some high mountain perhaps, when the fog began to thin up. Suppose, imagine the experience of those men who were used to that teeming world of the jungle and the fear, the death, and proliferation of that jungle state. That absolute chaos, not knowing what was going to happen the next day and so on. And suddenly finding themselves on the top of a mountain, let us say, face to face with the night sky. Now we can very readily understand such an experience, whether it came gradually or suddenly to a few people who climb a mountain, is not the point here. But the point is there that in the consciousness, in that very experience, mankind, the consciousness of man, became faced with what must obviously have seemed at once as two worlds, two realms. In one way, first down you had the world of the earth, the jungle of mist, the chaos of what we call today chance, where complete fear of imminent death all the time and so forth. And there you had that other world where soon you could realize that not only there was that great space with those lovely points of light in the sky moving, but that those motions were regular. That every night certain star moved there, that there was a periodicity to it, that the sun and the moon and all that operated according a very definite, predictable, reliable, trustable order. Well, take those two, that basic experience, and you have the source of all religion, of all philosophy, and of all science, and of astrology. Because, and we can trace that back very easily in certain old, particularly in China, in the old annals of China, you can trace the fact that the consciousness of primitive man, I mean, let's call it primitive, we don't know exactly what that meant, but was definitely faced with the problem and considered as its one great problem to project the order of the sky upon the chaos of the earth, so as to transform the earth and make of that very strange, dark and difficult, chaotic world of the earth, of the surface of the earth, something that would reproduce and be fecundated by the rhythmic order of the sky. Now you have that absolutely basic in all Chinese civilization, and particularly in Chinese astrology, because, and their astrology in China was the same thing as government, because the two were practically indistinguishable, also music. There you see, you had the concept of the sky, which is the realm of order, the realm of periodicity, expectability, predictability, and you had the world of the realm of the earth, which they considered called the state. And in between those two, that's a very important point, in between those two, as the link between the two, was the emperor, the celestial, you see, the man who was an incarnation of order, though he was a man, you see. And as the link, or perhaps you should consider it better, as a focus, as a lens. If that lens was pure, if it was well formed, well shaped, then the order of the sky would reproduce itself perfectly on the earth, on the state, and you have a perfect state. If in the contrary some little failing happens on the lens of the emperor, if the emperor got a bad emperor or got disordered, you see, then of course the state would turn completely bad, because it would have no longer the reflection of order, and it would proliferate and in a tumultuous, chaotic way of what we call, what they call, the earth nature, or human, what we call today, or we have called all through the century, Christian century, human nature. Now, let's go a stage further and realize that the picture that we have there is exactly the same picture at a different level of interpretation of that we find in Christianity. Except that there, the Christian picture is as transcendentalized, as it were. The physical picture of the sky and of the earth and of the emperor into a celestial realm of divine order, into the chaotic realm of human nature, which had been completely upset and made chaotic by the original sin, and the possibility of this chaotized human nature, disturbed human nature, being reordered, saved, redeemed by the incarnation of a Son of God, who therefore would be a celestial, who would be the project, the Son of the sky, and by being in between the earth and the sky, in being a fusion of divine nature and human nature, a God-man, would therefore perpetually, timelessly enact the linking, the reordering of human nature in terms of the celestial order. Now that is the religious picture, but you have the same picture in Plato, more or less, at least what we think Plato said, which may not be at all what Plato thought, of a world of essence, a world of ideas, a realm of perfect beauty and form and order and so on, and a world of existence, of shadows and conflicts and struggles and so on. And through the Christian century, you have had that conflict between trying to rise from the world of the shadow, the human nature, to redeem human nature, transform it into divine nature, reorder it, re-celestialize it, so that it became one more a perfect reflection of the divine order of the sky. Now, you have that same situation in astrology originally, because originally, the astrology of Chaldea, of India, Egypt, and so on, first you had in China that great picture of the sky as a whole, but then it broke down, it began to be broken up into celestial hierarchies, the 12 great building hierarchies, zodiacal hierarchy, which represented the 12 phases of the relationship between the sun and the earth over the year. And the stars were considered as the bodies of the gods, directing mortals, directing, controlling all Earth's elements on the surface of the Earth. So that you had there, therefore, a divine order of the stars, the planets, the sun, the moon, and the control of everything that happened in the Earth, on the Earth. That, of course, was very dominant in those agricultural civilizations along the great river, whether it was of the Indus or Egypt or China, where everything was depending on seasonal activities, or perhaps on the floods of the river, and everything was agricultural, therefore, on the perpetuation of the seed, on the multiplication of the seed, on the idea of fertility, and so on. So those great forces of the sky were controlling all that, and by trying to work with them, and isolate the moment where one was good, the other one was bad, when one was constructive, one destructive, try to order the things to avoid the storm, avoid the drought, and so on, avoid the unfortunate condition in the kingdom if you wanted to swallow up another kingdom, and so on. Now that is, of course, the archaic, you might say, picture of astrology. Today, we have an attempt among many astrologers, particularly in Europe, but also here, to scientificalize that picture by saying that the solar system is a vast electromagnetic field and that the planets moving through it induce electrical current or some kind of current. Those currents are, of course, whirling through the whole solar system. The Earth is in the midst of the solar system. And as those planets are all sorts of magnets, according to the angle at which their currents operate, you have this and this particular things operating on the Earth. Which is perfectly nice and perfectly possible, a picture. But the only trouble about it is that it doesn't explain at all the majority of the things, or the techniques and the approaches which we take still today in astrology. There are, in Germany, for instance, a group called the Cosmobiological Group, which repudiate the term astrology and use the term cosmobiology instead, and want everything to be highly scientific and based on statistics and based on and all sorts of almost prismatic analysis of the planets, their position, how far they are, the kind of rays they emanate, and so on. And this may very well be a science of the future. But there again, you see, you are thinking in terms of rays, which are heating, or currents, or something, which are heating the Earth, which are doing something to the Earth, and therefore you have merely transformed the bodies of the gods into electromagnets. Now, the attitude which I take, and very few people indeed take, is that you have to look at astrology in a very different way. And that what you deal when you deal with an astrological picture, you are dealing with the sky as a whole. That's again, you might say the old primitive Chinese idea. You deal with the sky as a whole, which, and there is a difference in a sense, which reveals the order which is inherent in existence. It is not that the sky is doing something to you, but that the picture of the sky, which is represented in your birth chart, is the individualized picture of order according to the point in time and space in which you are born, which therefore form what you are. In other words, you deal there with a formula of relationship between elements of existence. Those elements of existence are represented by mainly the planets and a few other factors, which I don't want to go into, too technical. And what you have there, at any moment in the sky or in your birth chart, if you are dealing with your life, you have the formula of order at that particular point of existence, because you are looking at it from that point of existence. Therefore, it is your picture of order. It is oriented to you, or you are oriented to it, but in a real sense, it is oriented to you. Yes. And, as I have always said, since my first book, Astrology of Personality, way back in the 30s, early 30s, astrology, as I see it, is an algebra of life. If it is a science, it is not an empirical science, it's not a statistical science, it is a purely deductive algebraic science. It's more like mathematics. But, in other words, what it tries to do is to reveal at every point to the person at that point what the inherent order in that existence, that particular individual existence, is. It reveals it in what you might call, for lack of a better term, a symbolic manner. You might say, but who is making that symbol? Nobody. The only point is that order is just as much inherent within you as it is projected in the sky. But you have that, say, that picture, which you have in several cases, in almost every phase of existence, that when something is far away, you have a distant perspective on it. You see it as a whole, you see. Because you are not involved in the detail of it. You are not swayed by it, its eddies, you might say. You are far enough from it that you can understand that things as order, whereas if you look at your body, it's very difficult, you see. If you look at your life, you may find that all the events of it follow each other in a very chaotic, disordered manner. You don't know why this happened at that time, why that happened at that time, what was the meaning of this, or whatever the meaning of that. But the order is there, you see. But you can't see it because you are too involved in it, you are too subjective to it. But if you can, as it were, have enough recoil or recul, enough back perspective on it, then you would see it just as well. The question is this. You have the same picture, more or less, in modern science, when you speak very much of statistics, laws which are functioning when it is a very high statistic level, billions or millions of cases. But the point is that even when you have a very low order of statistical values, dealing only with a few individuals or with one individual, the same order is there also. You see. But it takes a different shape, it takes a different formulation. Whereas when you have high statistical level, you can speak of a law of causation, or that, because things seem to neutralize each other and go mass in certain directions. But when you deal with individual or a few people, a few individual factors, you have another point that develops, another approach, another realization, that that order manifests as the fact that for every need, every individual need, there is an individual solution. In other words, what you consider as the need, as the problem, is merely one phase of the total order. The solution is there, around it. Yes. But you can't see it. The situation is, therefore, to try to make clear when that instinctual drive, which I believe is the very basic law, though I don't like the term law very much in that case, the basic principle of all existence, that everything tends to do what it needs to do. I think at one time, sir, I don't know if it has been changed now, but I remember reading a book, or I think it was Einstein or somebody else, who said that the basic law of the universe, that everything was doing that was easiest to do. I mean, the easier path or whatever is exact the formulation, perhaps I am wrong in it. But it is not so much a matter of easiness as I see, though it amounts very much to the same thing. Everything tends to do what it needs to do, because that everything means simply that something has become individualized out of the universe, as it were. It has, to an extent, separated itself to the universe so that it has developed an ego consciousness, an I consciousness. The moment it does that, and the moment it finds itself with other people or other factors which have also developed that ego consciousness, there are conflicts, there are struggles. Therefore, problems arise. Yes. If one could not be upset or too influenced or too startled or too frightened by the effect of the other ego or the other individualized factor around you, then you would still do the natural thing, which would be to follow that which is the solution to your own need. But unfortunately, we don't, because we are so involved in the fictitious kind of relationship built by society, by religion, morality, and all those things like that. And so, it is valuable to gain a perspective on ourselves by looking as far as we can from ourselves, where the same order is. Yes. And so, to me, I define astrology, usually, as a technique for the solving of individual problems in terms of the natural order inherent in the person having this problem. In other words, astrology reveals your, what you might call, if you want, using the whole Chinese term, your celestial nature. Your birth chart is you as a celestial. It is, if you want to use a religious idea, I don't like particularly, but I mean that it may drive a point, it is God's idea for you. It is the things, another way of speaking which I don't like, it is what you are meant to do. More simply, it is what you are. It's you. It is you as individuality, which is the space factor, that is to say the particular relationship between the elements of your personality and your human nature, physiological and psychological nature. And it is you also as destiny. And I mean by destiny simply the same thing as individuality, but in terms of a time factor. Individuality is what you are as a space factor. Destiny is what you are as a time factor. You develop through your life the potential, theoretically, let us say, you develop through your life the potentiality which are inherent in your birth chart, which is the symbol of your individuality, just as the oak, as it grows into oakhood, develops the potentiality which are in the acorn. There is no difference between the acorn and the development of the oaks to a full maturity. They are two aspects of the same thing. One is a pattern of potentiality, the other one is the process of actualization of those potentialities. In other words, all what you can do which make any sense at all, is to actualize what is your birth potential, what you were potentially at the moment of, and there I think is the important point, at the moment of your first breath, when you became individualized, when the rhythm of your heart and your lung and all that gave you an individual rhythm of your own. And for the first time, you have your individual rhythm. You are, to an extent at least, an autonomous cosmos, a microcosmos. And from that moment on, as that is there, you are kind of tuned, as it were, to the universe. And the universe follow you at every step, as it were, offering you the solution of your problem. And therefore, when you realize this, you realize that so much of what is usually talked about in astrology makes absolutely no sense. I mean, from that point of view. There is no chart which is better than any other chart. Because it is best for what you have to do. It's you, and therefore, I mean, it's neither better nor worse and so on. It just simply is you. There are no bad aspects of planets. There are no unfortunate planets, no unfortunate signs, or anything like that, because all that is part of the pattern of your total individuality and your total destiny. And to try to shy away from either one or the other for the good, or to love too much another like the good one, is just simply introduce elements into the development of your acorn hood into the hook hood, which will tend to deviate the process. There you have, therefore, the idea of the gestalt, the idea of the complete form of the chart, where it is not any point in it that matters, but the relatedness of all. It is the gestalt of all. And nothing is unnecessary. Nothing is better than other. Oh, there are things which are easier, of course, than others. But what is easy? If you are a diamond in the rough and you want to fulfill the potentiality of that diamond, you have to pass through that tedious grinding and severing process and all that. I am quite sure the mineral doesn't enjoy it. Yes. Neither do we enjoy our crisis or our catharsis and so on. But if we can see crisis as catharsis, if we can see it as a grinding process which will bring out of that, whatever you call it, gong, that matrix of the stone, bring out the clear, translucent facet of the diamond, then by no means can you make sense if you say that it's a bad process. Now, of course, a diamond cutter may grind the diamond and grind it in the wrong way, or put the grinder in his finger, and that causes all sorts of trouble. And in a certain sense, of course, through the very complex pattern of human relationship, because you are not alone in the world, and the pressure of other people upon you and other charts upon your chart, or the pressure of the world conditions into that chart which is developing into you being developing and so on, you are in the midst of those pressures. But those very pressures can be interpreted in terms of opportunity, because after all, you are born at that time. Therefore, you have in you the capacity potentially to take care of it. How much you will take care of it, how much you will actualize of your potentiality, that sometimes doesn't matter. There is not one person in a million that actualized, or billion, I don't know, who actualized the full potentiality of one's own nature. But we can try to do as much as we can. Now, when you take such an attitude, you see, you are transforming, you are passing from an ethical attitude to an aesthetical attitude. And the approach which I recognize for astrology is an aesthetical approach. You consider a birth chart as a work of art. It is every moment the universe is God's work of art, if you want to put it that way in a religious sense. Every chart, that is to say, every relationship of the universe to that particular point at which you are looking at the universe, is a little work of art. All what you have to find out is to, well, if you want to use the term in a very broad sense, the meaning of it. But the term meaning, I don't mean by meaning the intellectual meaning. If I see a modern work of art, non-objective or whatever you want to call it, transcendental painting, abstract painting, and so on, which is not an intellectual divertissement or tour de force in techniques and so on, which is really a spontaneous and rich thing. It's silly to try to think of the meaning of it in an intellectual sense. What does it mean? The person that comes doesn't, I've never seen. Oh, what does it mean? It means nothing. That is not what I mean by meaning. That's an intellectual meaning. Neither when you speak of symbol, when I speak of symbol in terms of astrology, do I mean a literal symbol, traditional, as it has been developed in a cultural tradition and so on. It is simply, in the real sense of the term, a sign. It is an indication, it is a revelation, the real word of revelation. You reveal something which is essentially there, but you cannot, the moment you talk about it, or you express it in a work of art, you veil it again. So it is revealed. Every revelation are new veiling of original experience by, in terms of words or concepts or ordinary experience of the humanity to which it is addressed. And in that sense, the universe is the revelation of the total harmony of the cosmos. If you want to call that God, fine, I have no objection to the term. Yeah. But you have to know what you are talking about if you mean that. And so in that sense, we all are gods in the making. We have all our divine nature because we have all that. We are all a particular aspect at a particular point of time and space of that divine harmony, or that complete, total, absolute, if you want to call it, harmony. So that you have there a situation where when you face a problem, and if you cannot normally solve that problem because you don't know, your angle of vision is very limited. You don't know what other people will do, you don't know exactly how far certain gesture or certain activity may go. So, if you have no way, as it were, to solve your problem, or you have lost that way, in a sense, perhaps even better way of saying it, then, you see, you can ask someone who becomes the interpreter, as it were, of that divine celestial order as applied to you in your predicament. Now, all sorts of very strange things, of course, happen, and you have to understand many things which are very startling to most people, but for which there is pretty good of a traditional background in the Hindu philosophy, for instance. You have to realize something, and that is that the more you work with astrology, the more the aspects work. And unfortunately, that has a curious way that it is usually the most difficult thing which works the most. Why? Well, let's go back to that idea of India, of the guru. Well, one of the functions of the guru, one which is not usually publicized, but which is very basic, and you find it in many texts, it is, you all know the term, to precipitate the karma of the chela. In other words, the dynamic intensity of that guru who is open to the constant flow of life and change, you see, unite itself with the inertia of the chela who is trying to maintain his ego the way it is, with its privilege and its set pattern. And therefore, force, not consciously necessarily, certainly not necessarily deliberately, though I think sometimes it may be, something to happen, which the chela might have the opportunity of making it happen, but is frightened to death of having it happen, because it would mean trouble. So it forced the person to re-enter the flow of dynamic existence. Well, the same thing happened to a large extent in astrology. As you watch the transits and the progression, you probably know more or less what that means in your chart and all that, you are identifying yourself with the flowing waves of the universe. And to the extent to which you believe in it, to the extent to which you have seen it happen, to the extent to which you are open to it, to the extent to which you don't want to miss any significant experience without any ethical meaning of it. And I don't mean unethical experience, but I mean without it being good or bad or fortunate or unfortunate and so on. To the extent you do that, you are open to that flow of life. To that extent, things begin to happen at every moment. Every opportunity, you might say, that the stars give you, that the universe gives you to have something happen, it happens. And the question is, do you accept it or do you not accept it? Are you frightened by it or are you not? Are you coping with it or are you becoming so tired of it and so depressed about it, which is the normal thing to do, of course, that you hang back and you say, oh, no more, I have enough. You see, and you throw your books in the gutter or something like that, or you say goodbye to your guru and so on, because that's too much. Well, that, of course, is a situation which you can only understand if you have that basic philosophy about astrology. And if you realize that actually the important thing of astrology is not to predict events, but to open yourself to the flow of universal existence as it applies to you and in relation, in terms of your own individual determination at the beginning of your life, of your birth potential. So that all what you can do, really, significantly in astrology, is to show you the trend, to situate the events as they happen within certain cycles, within certain patterns of development. So that the things which, if you deal with astrology, from this philosophical point of view, you have never to be hypnotized by the pattern as pattern, not being hypnotized by one aspect isolated from all the totality of other aspects. People come to you and say, oh, I'm going to have a terrible year because Saturn is over my sun. But what about all the other planets? Are they there? Yes. But if you, in the contrary, begin to feel the whole thing there, oh yes, you can understand certain cycles of Saturn, 30-year cycle. You can try to feel more or less the rhythm of your past. You must feel that 30-year rhythm, let us say, and know where you are in it in some way. But you know where you are in it, you don't get out of it. You stay in it. And that, as I see it, is the only way in which astrology can be used spiritually from the point of view of a person who does not seek to attain power or to do something startling by controlling things, but who simply, naturally, spontaneously, freely, beautifully, joyously, if you can, despairingly, actualize your birth potential. Thank you.
This is the end of Astrology for New Minds by Dane Rudjar. The preceding audio is copyrighted by Leila Rudjar Hill and was brought to you by Rita, the Rudjar Institute for Transpersonal Activity. Learn more about Rita or contribute to the ongoing legacy of Dane Rudjar at www.rudjarinstitute.org. For the complete selection of free downloads of audio presentations by Dane Rudjar, visit www.rudjaraudioarchives.com.